Okay, welcome to the second round of this great struggle. Now, let me review a couple of points from yesterday. Yesterday, I insisted on the centrality of consciousness in our overall enterprise of explaining how the human reality is part of the real world, as a both consistent with the real world, and is real world meaning physics and chemistry, and at the same time is a natural consequence of the real world. I need to explain to you why money and property and government and marriage are a natural product of the operation of physical particles. And the two assumptions that underlie this entire investigation, and indeed I think underlie our contemporary worldview, are atomic physics, the idea that the world is composed of elementary physical particles, and evolutionary biology, that we're all the products of, well, 3 billion years of evolutionary history since the beginning of life on this planet. Now, it's very tempting for human beings to have a rather provincial and exaggerated view of themselves, so let me remind you of the humility of our condition. Our little solar system, we love it, but it is a rather suburban, a small enterprise, is one of 100 billion such stars in our galaxy. That is, there are 100 billion stars like ours. I don't know how many of them have planets like ours, but it's a lot. And that's just in our galaxy. How many galaxies are there? Well, roughly speaking, there are 100 billion galaxies. I mean, that's without putting too fine a point on it, without counting precisely. And that means it's a very big universe, and we're one tiny little portion of it. It seems to me unreasonable to suppose that we're the only place in the universe where life exists, but we have no idea what life might be like in other solar systems or in other galaxies. We can only guess, but it seems reasonable to suppose that we're not the only life form in the entire universe. The universe is a very big place. Let me tell you another item of bad news. I said we know that the universe consists entirely of physical particles, and we have an idea about how they're structured. We have pretty good theories of that. That is a total of 4% of the universe that we actually understand. What about the other 96%? Well, the other 96% consists of dark matter and dark energy. What's dark about it? What's dark is our ignorance, our sheer stupidity. It's epistemic darkness. We have overwhelming evidence that there must be dark energy because the galaxies keep getting farther apart. And we have overwhelming evidence there must be dark matter because there's too much gravity to be accounted for by the matter that we know about. Now, I'm really annoyed that those physicists haven't figured this out. They got 4% figured out, but they don't understand the other 96%. What am I paying these guys to do? Get busy. I'll do the philosophy part. I want you guys to do the physics part. Okay, so there's huge areas of ignorance. Nonetheless, we have to assume that the laws that operate in the part of the universe that we understand are universal, that they operate everywhere. And our enterprise in these lectures is to give an account of the human reality that's consistent with what we know about the total reality. I think it's a beautiful subject. For example, it is frequently said, the universe is expanding. What does that mean? I mean, if I say we decided to expand the kitchen into the backyard, that wouldn't make sense. But when the universe expands, what does it expand into? What's the backyard of the universe? And the answer, of course, is when they say the universe is expanding, what they really mean is the galaxies are getting further apart. And they are getting further apart, but that's what it means, I guess, to say the universe is expanding. Anyway, here we are. Now, this tiny little group of people huddled on this little planet, but we love it. It's our home. We're very happy with it. We don't treat it very well, but that's another problem. We're going to try and treat it better. Okay, now, here's an amazing thing. I said yesterday, the essence of the mental is consciousness. Descartes also said, the essence of the mental is consciousness. He meant something totally different. Well, the words sound a lot alike. What he meant is, there is a soul, and the soul has an Aristotelian essential trait, something that makes it what it is, and that's its consciousness, and this could not be part of the physical world. It's a separate ontological realm from the physical world. When I say the essence of the mind is consciousness, I mean as part of the physical world, as part of our ordinary reality of atoms, electrons, molecules, and all the rest of it. There is a biological phenomenon, along with digestion and photosynthesis, there is a biological phenomenon of consciousness, and that is the essential trait of the mind. And I'm going to be talking about how it works today. I'm going to be talking about how it works with intentionality. Our main subject today is intentionality. Before I get into the heart of that, though, I want to remind you of some of the difficulties of yesterday's lecture. I have this absurd discomfort in finding that I say something that seems to me totally obvious. The syntax of the computer program is insufficient for the semantics of human understanding. That sounds to me totally obvious. I say, indeed, the syntax of the computer program is only observer relative. It's only relative to our interpretation that we can treat the machine as implementing a computational process. Remembering that observer relative does not imply epistemically subjective. It can be an epistemically objective fact that my computer is carrying out the word program, implementing the word program, even though implementing the program is observer relative. I think all of that's kind of screamingly obvious. And then it seems to me also obvious that consciousness is a biological phenomenon like digestion or photosynthesis. Again, that seems obvious. Now, why is it that these points are routinely denied? Why is it that it's hard to convince people that the idea that the brain is a digital computer and the mind is a computer program, that that's obviously and demonstrably false? Why is it hard? And I think there are two reasons. One is, it sounds like science. If we say, we have discovered the brain is a digital computer, you want to know what the brain is, and you want to know what the mind is, well, we've at last made a scientific discovery. The brain is a digital computer, and the mind is a computer program. In an odd kind of way, this scientific conviction is also tied to a kind of dualism, because the idea it's a computer program has the consequence that the mind is something formal and abstract. That is a phrase I got from Dan Dennett, who said that. The mind is something formal and abstract. It's not formal and abstract. It's about as formal and abstract as digesting pizza. Nobody thinks, well, is this formal abstract process in the stomach? No, it's a whole lot of chemistry, and the same up here. So it's a weird mixture of behaviorism and dualism that inspires what I think is the false view. The behaviorism says what's real must be scientifically observable by third-person observations. That leads to behaviorism, and that's obviously false because we know that our own behavior is insufficient for the mental phenomena. I might behave as if I understood Chinese and still not understand Chinese. So behaviorism is obviously false. But the behaviorism is married to a peculiar kind of dualism that says you shouldn't think of the mind as like digestion or photosynthesis or like any other biological processes. You should think of it as something ethereal, something formal and abstract. And so they all pick examples which are very abstract, like thinking about mathematics or something like that. But think about such homely examples as feeling a headache or wanting to throw up or just feeling disgusted at some sight. Nobody thinks those things are formal, abstract, ethereal, that they're an essential part of our mental life. Okay, so I'm going to assume we've overcome the mistakes that you find in quite a lot of philosophers. Dennett's not the only one, but in a lot of philosophers you still find the mistakes of supposing what I call strong AI, strong artificial intelligence, or another word for it would be computer functionalism, that these give us an adequate account of how the real world works. They do not give us an adequate account. The whole thing is massively misconceived. Okay, well, let's now intentionality. What's the relation between intentionality and consciousness? Well, one of the reasons that consciousness is so interesting to us is that the forms of consciousness that are most important for us are intentional in the sense that they are directed at, about objects and states of affairs in the world. Intentionality, by definition, just means that feature of the mind by which it is directed at or about objects and states of affairs in the world independent of itself. So if I believe that Obama is president, if I want to have a drink of water, if I fear a decline in the income level of the University of California, if I am delighted that Barca beat, I mean, they always win. Glad they beat somebody the other day. All of those are intentional states. They're always about something or of or directed at. Not all mental states are intentional. So if you just have a state of undirected anxiety, you feel nervous. What are you nervous about? Well, you might not know what you're nervous about. You're just nervous. You feel anxious about something. Lectured to an audience of psychotherapists, and they said, that's our job, is when you're anxious, but you don't know what you're anxious about, we will find out what you're anxious about. That's the task of the psychoanalyst. And it reminded me of Freud saying that the task of psychoanalysis is to convert neurotic misery into ordinary human unhappiness. And maybe that's it. When you have ordinary human unhappiness, at least you know what you're unhappy about. Okay, so we're not going to assume that all forms of mental life are intentional. Indeed, not all forms of consciousness have intentionality. So there can be conscious anxiety where it's undirected, where you don't know. All the same, the forms of mental life that are most interesting are conscious intentionality. Think of perception when I see objects in front of my face. Think of intentional action when I plan on doing something and then I do it. Philosophers talk as if the essential forms of intentionality were belief and maybe belief and desire. I don't think so. I think those are very derivative. The most basic forms of intentionality, as we will see, are those where the intentional state relates you directly to the object. When you see the object in front of you or you intentionally raise your arm, you're in a direct, immediate, causal relation with the object of the intentionality. So our first question is, well, what is intentionality? What the hell is it supposed to be anyhow? Now notice, my whole assumption is it's a biological phenomenon, and we're going to analyze the logical structure of a biological phenomenon. What's its propositional, logical structure? What are its logical relations? And most people are not used to that, to the idea that natural phenomena have logical properties and logical relations. But I'm going to show you that they do. So our first question is, what is intentionality? And I'm going to explain it using analogies between intentionality and language. Now, that will make it look as if I'm trying to say intentionality is essentially linguistic, but that's not it. I'm going to use your understanding of language to get you to see how it carries over to intentionality. Later on, we'll see that language is derived from the more biologically basic pre-linguistic forms of intentionality. So I will tap your understanding of language to get you to see how the apply to language carry over to intentionality. But in the end, I don't know if today or tomorrow, I'll try to show you how language is a derivative, extended form of intentionality. Okay, so we're examining intentionality as a biological phenomena. I think that's right. Thirst, hunger, fear, desire, belief, all of those are biological phenomena, and they're all intentional. The first point of connection is this. If you think of language, it's common to make a distinction between the type or force of the speech act and the propositional content. So if I say, you will leave the room as a prediction, will you leave the room as a question, leave the room as an order, in each case you have the same propositional content presented as different types of speech act, different force, as Austin called it, illocutionary force. He got that term from Frege. Frege also used the notion of force. That distinction carries over exactly to the mind. So just as I can order you to leave the room and predict that you will leave the room and ask whether you will leave the room, so I can believe that you will leave the room, want that you should leave the room, fear that you will leave the room. The crucial difference is that the speech act is an action and the mental state is a state. So we're going to have the same distinction between the propositional content of the act and the illocutionary force. That distinction carries over exactly to the mind, because in the mind you have a distinction between the content and the type of mental state that has that content. Okay, so that's one crucial distinction. We're going to look at the contents of mental states. Now, not all mental states have an entire propositional content. If you're in love with Sally, or you hate Billy, or you admire Barack Obama, it looks like that's of this form, where you just have a referring expression. But I think that's that's misleading. It's going to turn out these also, these cases where there's just a reference to an object, that also has an entire proposition. Okay, so we've got first point of connection is the distinction between the content and the type. Now, a second point of connection is that language has different ways of relating to reality, and the mind carries over those same differences in ways of relating to reality. If you make a statement, the statement is supposed to represent how things are in the world, and thus we might say it has the word-to-world direction of fit. And this is going to be our second notion, direction of fit. If, on the other hand, you give an order, the order is not supposed to match how things are in the world. Rather, the world is supposed to change to match the content of the order. Of the statement, we say that it's true or false, and I'll use the downward arrow to represent the word-to-world direction of fit, and I use the upward arrow to represent the world-to-word direction of fit. The downward arrow is marked by saying obeyed. In the case of a statement, it's true. The upward arrow, in the case of an order, is marked by saying it's obeyed. The simplest test for whether or not something has this direction of fit is, can you literally say that it's true or false? Whereas this direction of fit is, as in orders and promises, is not true or false, but it's obeyed or disobeyed, kept or broken. The point is, typically we want language to match reality. There are two basic ways that language matches reality. We'll see some more later, but the two basic ways are, you make an utterance that's supposed to be true about how the world is, and thus it has word-to-world direction of fit, or you give an order or promise, and that's supposed to change reality so that reality matches the words. It has the word-to-word direction of fit. The best all-time example of this was given by one of my teachers, Elizabeth Anscombe, and here's her example. She says, imagine her a wife gives her husband a shopping list, and on this shopping list, she tells him that she wants him to bring home, let's say, beer, bacon, and butter. Okay, now, the husband goes with this list to the supermarket, and he goes around the supermarket taking items on the shelf and putting them in the supermarket cart. He's changing reality to match the content of the list. It has the word-to-word direction of fit. The list functions like an order. Suppose he's followed by a detective, a policeman, who wants to write down everything he buys. So the policeman writes down beer, bacon, and butter. However, the policeman's list functions totally differently. The policeman's list is supposed to match how things are. It has the word-to-world direction of fit, whereas the husband's list doesn't match how things are. It's supposed to change. The world is supposed to change to match the content of the list. This list has the downward or word-to-world direction of fit. This one, the wife's list, has the upward or world-to-word direction of fit. Has everybody got that? I think it's kind of interesting because, as Elizabeth pointed out, there's a huge difference if you make a mistake. See, suppose the detective gets home and he suddenly realized, I wrote down bacon, but the guy didn't buy bacon. He bought pork chops. So he says, well, I can fix that. Erase bacon and write pork chops. The husband gets home. Wife says, you idiot. I wrote down bacon and you bought pork chops. The husband can't say, honey, we'll fix that. We'll just cross out bacon and write pork chops. Okay, now it works for the detective. It doesn't work for the husband. The husband's list is supposed to change reality to match the list. The wife's list, the detective's list, is just supposed to match an independently existing reality. Some speech acts don't really have a direction of fit because we take it for granted. We just presuppose it. So if I say, I apologize for stepping on your face, well, I'm not trying to get your face stepped on. It's not the word-to-word direction of fit, and I'm not claiming. I just presuppose it. So we could say that we've got this direction of fit and this one, and then we have what we might call presupposed fit, where we take it for granted there's a fit. Now later on, we're going to get to some fascinating speech acts which have both directions of fit at once, where you change reality by representing it as being changed. And that sounds like a very strange operation, but I'm going to argue, not today, we don't have the tools yet, that's the key to understanding human civilization. You become a professor or a husband or a citizen or a president or a car owner because we use language to change reality by representing reality as being so changed. I'll get to that later, but those are speech acts that have the double of fit. We're not there yet. Okay, but now as far as the mind is concerned, these distinctions carry over exactly to the mind because I can, just as my statement has the word-to-world direction of fit, so my belief has the mind-to-world direction of fit, and beliefs like statements can be true or false. And just as my order has the world-to-word direction of fit and can be obeyed or disobeyed, but not true or false, so my desire has the world-to-word direction of fit. And just as my apology has a presupposed fit, so my feeling sorry or my feeling glad has a presupposed fit. So we've got a second connection between language and mind, and that is, not only do you have the notion of content and type that carries over from language to mind, but you have the notion of direction of fit. Now there's a third connection between mind and language, which is going to be important when we get a theory of language, and that is, whenever you perform, one of these, perform a speech act with a propositional content, you express one of these. Every time you make a statement, you express a belief. Every time you give an order, you express a desire. Every time you make a promise, you express an intention. And the proof is shown by the fact that it's inconsistent to perform the speech act and deny the expressed psychological state, because the expressed psychological state is the sincerity condition on the performance of the speech act. So the sincerity condition on making a statement, believe it. If you don't believe it, it's insincere. The insincerity condition on making an order is you should want the hearer to do the thing that he's being ordered to do. The sincerity condition on making a promise is that you should intend to do the thing you promised to do. And in every case, this is shown by the fact that you can't consistently perform one of these and deny the existence of the sincerity condition. Now, listen to this, because all of these are absurd in the same way. I'm in Girona, but I don't believe I'm in Girona. I ordered you to leave the room, but I don't want you to leave the room. I promised to come and see you, but I don't intend to come and see you. I apologize for stepping on your face, but I'm not one bad damn bit sorry that I stepped on your face. I thank you for giving me the money, but I'm not the least bit grateful that you gave me the money. Now, this is a very interesting philosophical point. All of those are crazy for the same reason, but it's not logical inconsistency. It's perfectly consistent to suppose that I apologized and I'm not sorry. Perfectly consistent to suppose that I made a promise but I don't intend. What is inconsistent is to perform the speech act and deny the corresponding sincerity condition, because the speech act, in virtue of being a speech act of that type, is an expression of that sincerity condition. Whenever you make a promise, you express an intention. Wherever you give an order, you express a desire, and so on. This, by the way, has a name. It's called Moore's paradox. Moore was puzzled by the fact that it seems puzzling to say it's Tuesday, but I don't believe it's Tuesday, because the hypothesis that it's Tuesday is perfectly consistent with the hypothesis that I don't believe that it's Tuesday. Moore never got a satisfactory answer to the paradox. I'm telling you, here's the answer. It's perfectly general. Every speech act that has this form expresses a sincerity condition that has this form, and it's inconsistent to perform the speech act and thus express the sincerity condition while at the same time denying the existence of the sincerity condition. So it's part of the theory of speech acts that you get these two. But I want you to see now that we've got a very tight connection between language and mind, because every speech act of this form is an expression of a psychological state of that form, and the existence of the psychological state is what determines whether the speech act is sincere or not. Okay, here's a fourth point of connection that I think is crucial, and that's this. Whenever you have a speech act that has this form with a propositional content and a direction of fit, then the fit will either be satisfied or not. The statement will be true or false. The order will be obeyed or disobeyed. The promise will be kept or broken. And we might say, every speech act is a representation of its conditions of satisfaction. Truth in the case of statements, obedience in the case of orders, being kept in the case of promises. And I want to say that carries over exactly to the mind, and this is the key to understanding intentionality. Every intentional state with a direction of fit, one of these two, is a representation of its conditions of satisfaction. And that's the key to understanding intentionality. Intentional states, beliefs, hopes, fears, desires, all represent their conditions of satisfaction. They represent the state of affairs in the world that is there if the belief is true, if the desire is satisfied, if the intention is carried out. So I'm going to argue that the key to understanding intentionality gets more complicated later, but the simple key to understanding intentionality is to think of intentional states that have a direction of fit, that is either this direction of fit or that direction of fit, is to think of them as representations of reality, successful or not successful. It may or may not succeed, but they're representations of their conditions of satisfaction. Well, that leaves us with a lot of questions, though. How about intentional states that don't have a whole propositional content? How about intentional states where you presuppose the fit? What are they representations of? Well, we'll get to that. I'm going to get to those complexities. The simple idea I want you to get at now is this. There are four points of connection between mind and language. And these are going to be the key to understanding language when we get to language later today or tomorrow. And the key is this. The four points of connection are the distinction between propositional content and type carries over to both language and mind. The different directions of fit carries over to both language and mind. The sincerity condition is an intrinsic connection between language and the mind, because every performance of a speech act of this type is an expression of that condition, which determines whether or not it's sincere. And both language and mind represent reality and thus represent their conditions of satisfaction. And that's going to be the key to understanding the operation of the mind. However, it gets more complicated. So let's introduce some of the complexities. All right. Now, the first thing I want you to call, as far as the complexity is concerned, is I've been talking as if these functioned in isolation, as if you just had this structure and it worked all by itself. But of course, the intentional state only works in relation to a whole lot of other intentional states. I believe in that I'm in Girona. What else do I have to believe in order to believe I'm in Girona? Well, I have to believe that Girona is a part of a country. And in fact, that country is called Spain. Many people in Girona have an ambiguous attitude toward Spain. But that's not so essential. But I have to believe that there's a territory, that this territory exists over a certain period of time, that in this territory there are people who live there, that they speak a language, or they speak a couple of languages. They speak Spanish and Catalan. So I can't just have this item isolated belief. I believe I'm in Girona. I can only have that as part of a network. I have a network of intentional states, and why not think of it as a network, as a whole lot of intentional states that are connected. And we might say that intentionality only functions, an intentional state only determines its conditions of satisfaction within a network of other intentional states. And the network of intentional states serves in part to determine the content of the original intentional state. So if I say I'm in Girona, I believe I'm in Girona, somebody says, well, what does that mean exactly, you're in Girona? And I say, well, I'm not sure, but I think Girona is kind of a great big chocolate cake and you're supposed to eat your way out of it. Well, okay, that's an interesting thought, but it's not, I'm not right, okay? I have misunderstood the claim that I'm in Girona if I think the main problem in Girona is to be able to eat your way out of the whole cake. So that's a part of the network. The network determines the content. Let me put it more carefully. The intentional state only determines its conditions of satisfaction relative to a network of other intentional states. And in English, that view has got a name. It's called holism, or sometimes network holism. We have to use the H here. I would really want to try to say it's holism, but English speakers can't pronounce that. Oh, who, what, where, when? We have to drop the H and just say holism. All right. Now, is that enough? You got an intentional state, and it gets its condition of satisfaction from its relations to a whole lot of other intentional states. Is that enough? Well, my life would be easier if it was, but in fact, the whole system, this whole network of intentional states, only functions against our ground. And that's a messy notion, but I'm going to try and explain it to you. So you got a network, but the network never is sufficient by itself to determine the satisfaction. You have to have a background of things you take for granted. So if I say, I'm in Girona, I have a belief that I'm in Girona and that there's a network, it would seem odd to say, well, and one of the things I believe about Girona is it's located in space and time. The problem with that is that's too fundamental. You open a geography book and it doesn't say Girona is located in space and time. That's part of the background taken for granted. It's part of what's presupposed. Much of what is presupposed is just doing things, ways of behaving. And I behave in Girona as if I took for granted that it's located in space and time. Think of what it is, for example, for me to be in Barcelona and intend to go to Girona. Well, I have to know how to make my way to the railway station. And I have to know what it is to get on a train and move by train from Barcelona to Girona. But that isn't so much a set of beliefs as it's a set of ways of behaving, an understanding of how to do things in the world. The leading author on the background in the past century is Ludwig Wittgenstein. Much of later Wittgenstein is about the background, about the things that we take for granted, which determine the conditions of satisfaction. He wouldn't use that jargon, but I'm using it. It's about the background. And his best book on the background is called On Certainty, and he even uses the notion of background. He says there's a sort of bedrock of the direction that the stream goes, and that's the background. Sometimes you get changes in the background. Sometimes you get dramatic changes in the background, where our whole background about space and time was altered by relativity theory. Instead of thinking that we live in a huge empty box, and then material objects come and populate this empty box. Einstein taught us, no, if you took away the material objects, you take away space and time, because space and time just consists in relations among objects. That's a huge change in the background. So the background is not fixed forever. And of course, in addition to these basic physical backgrounds, there's a biological background and a cultural background. How do people relate to each other? What's the appropriate form of behavior? And often, the background is inexplicit. Typically, it's inexplicit. People are unaware of the background presuppositions there. And this shows itself in all sorts of ways. How much do people eat? How fast do they eat, for example? Or how do they relate to each other in conversations? Here's an interesting distinction. It's a background distinction. How close to each other do people stand when they're having a conversation? Now, I've noticed Englishmen tend to stand further apart than Italians. So there's a common scene at international conferences where the Italian is trying to get close enough to the Englishman to have a conversation, and the Englishman is trying to get at a civilized distance to have a conversation. Neither is thinking about this. It's just each is trying to feel comfortable. The Italian wants to get close enough so he can actually explain something to this guy, and the Englishman just wants to feel comfortable in having this conversation. That's a good example of the background. It isn't, they've got a theory. You've got to stand 37 centimeters apart, because of course, the 37 centimeter rule won't work. If, for example, it's someone you're in love with, or a small baby, 37 centimeters long distance. It's just, there are certain ways of behaving which seem appropriate to us, and others make us uncomfortable, and that's the okay. So now, here's what I've said. We need the following notions to understand intentionality. You need the notion of propositional content and type of state, and you need that notion even if the content is not an entire proposition. You need the notion of direction of fit and conditions of satisfaction. You need the notion of the network and the background. What's the dividing line between the network and the background? I don't know, and probably can't give a theoretical answer. It's just intuitively that in which I believe that Barcelona is a bigger city than Girona, and that's a network belief. In that sense, the idea that both Barcelona and Girona are located in space and time, that's not another belief. That's something I take for granted about how the world works. That's part of the background. But I don't think we can give a sharp distinction between the network and the background. All right, now then, if I'm right so far, now how are we doing for time? How much time before we break? I'll speak a little more and then we'll stop for questions. Okay. I said that there are some intentional states that don't appear to have an entire proposition. If I'm in love with Sally, or I admire Barack Obama, it looks like that's an intentional state like this. It just has a reference, but it doesn't have a whole proposition. But I think, in fact, you can only have that as part of the network. And indeed, the elements of the network do have conditions of satisfaction. So if I'm in love with Sally, well, I have to have a set of beliefs and desires. I have to believe that Sally's an actual person. I have to believe that she has such and such traits. I have to find certain things about her desirable. And that is to say, I must desire that she has them. I have to have certain desires about my relations to her. Now, notoriously, lovers differ in their desires, and they differ in the sort of beliefs that they have about the beloved. But all the same, you got to have some beliefs. If I believe she's a prime number or that she never existed, then it would be very hard to describe my case as being in love with her, all right? I once gave this as a lecture, and a guy in the audience said, yes, but he had been in love with Carol Landis, and she died in a plane crash in 1937. She was an American movie star. Okay, you can have her back to 1937, but she did exist at some time. If you thought she never existed, or that her existence was like that of a prime number, then it's a bit peculiar to say it's a great love affair that you have. Okay, so you have to have the network in the background. Now here's the claim I want to make. I said the key to understanding intentionality is conditions of satisfaction. Every intentional state with a direction of fit, this one or this one, is a representation of its conditions of satisfaction. But what about intentional states that presuppose a fit, like being sorry or being glad? What about intentional states that don't have a whole proposition, like being in love with Sally or hating Bill or admiring Barack Obama? And there I want to say it's not obvious that they have conditions of satisfaction too. But when you look to the network, you see there's no way you can admire Obama or be in love with Sally, or be sorry that you stepped on somebody, or be glad that the economy is getting better. There's no way you can have those without having beliefs and desires, and the beliefs and the desires do have conditions of satisfaction. So I'm going to say, in general, the secret of intentionality is intentional states are representations of their conditions of satisfaction with one or the other of these directions of fit. Now, we'll get later to more complexities when we get to how we create civilization using this apparatus. But right now, we just got a biological phenomenon, human intentionality, and human intentionality for evolutionary purposes has to relate us to the environment. And the way it relates us to the environment is by representation. Our beliefs and desires represent how things are in the case of beliefs, or how we'd like them to be in the case of desires. Now, that's the bare bones of intentionality, but we're going to find out it gets to be incredibly rich when you talk about perception. When you see your hand in front of your face, you don't just represent your hand, you see that damned hand. And when you raise your arm, you don't just represent the arm going up, you actually make it go up right then and there. Now, what's going on in those cases? Now, that's when intentionality gets very rich and much more exciting. Take the emotions. Philosophers like to talk about beliefs and desires, these abstract things, maybe computational states, but talk about gutsy intentional states like being madly in love or being in a rage or being in despair. And there, it seems odd to say, well, you know, it's just more representations. No, I think that's much richer. I'm going to talk about that. But let's stop and have a, what do we have? Questions now? How do we do it? Okay, questions and then a break? Okay, so questions so far. By the way, I've been going very fast. If you understand all of this so far, you understand more than most professional philosophers about intentionality. But that's all right. You're going to understand a hell of a lot more before the day is over. Okay.
Thank you. Just a short question on the relation between the background and the network, or the on the intermediate space. Activities such as swimming or riding a bike, the style, taste, how do you see them? Could you see them as activities that partake both in the background and in the network?
Yeah, okay. I think the idea that we have in our tradition that all cognition is representation and that it all has propositional content and direction of fit, that is refuted by physical skills like being able to ride a bike. It's tempting to think, well, the bike rider is following certain rules, namely that the center of gravity must always be within the plane of the forces of gravity and the surface of the ground. I don't think bike riders know such rule. I used to be a ski racer. Most ski racers have no idea of the theory of the physics of the ski. You're all taught to make certain types of turns, and you learn, make these turns and acquire a background ability to make the turns. Now, the physicist will tell you, and this is a beautiful physical fact, in a perfectly carved turn, the angle of the reverse camber of the ski is exactly equal to the angle of the turn. I think that's beautiful. Most ski racers don't care a damn about it. The theory of the physics doesn't interest them at all. And this is the difference between American ski coaches and Austrian ski coaches. If you ski with an American ski coach, it's very theoretical. And you get through the run, and the coach will say things like, now, I want you to get your elbows closer to your body and your hands a bit further out. Get your hands further out, but keep the elbows in close and make the smooth adjustment when you go foot to foot. Austrian ski coaches never say that. What they say, you say to the coach, what should I do? Schneller, go faster. Yeah, but coach, Ellenbogen, what about my elbows? Schneller. Go faster. And this, you see, the American coaches have all been to university. They all graduated in something. They all can produce sentences. The Austrian coaches of my generation were local peasant boys who happened to be great skiers, and they skied like hell. And they usually beat us. My favorite was the Innsbruck Olympics, where Jean-Claude Killy skied a perfect textbook race. Nothing was wrong. Absolute perfection. And he was a full second and a half behind the Austrian Ernst Hinterseer, because Hinterseer didn't give a damn about the technique. He just went schneller. Okay, now, the French, as usual, were too theoretical at the beginning, but they learned a lesson. And the next Olympics, Killy beat everybody. He won every, of course it was held in France, that helped him, but he did beat everybody. Now, the point I'm making now is this. In the case of physical skills, our intellectual tradition makes it look as if you must have, in a cyclist case, for example, you must have some implicit theoretical knowledge. You must understand some theory about gravity, even if you only understand it unconsciously. I want to say that's wrong. You just acquire the physical skill, and it becomes ingrained in your body. Your body will take over. So if you're a good skier, your body will automatically adjust to changes in the. In fact, your leg will move up in response to a bump before you're conscious of it, before you're aware of it, because the reflexes take over. I'm not sure this answers your question, but it's a deep point that I want to get across to you. The background abilities should not be thought of as an implicit theory. It's a pre-theoretical skill that enables you to ski or to walk. When I walk, do I follow the first one foot, then another foot rule? There's no such rule. I just walk. And of course, in order to do that, I have to have a certain ways of relating to gravity, otherwise I fall over. But as provided I'm doing it right, I don't fall over. Okay, next question.
Well, about the representational theory. A lot of scientists believe in this theory, and for example, Einstein. Einstein believe in this theory, and well, they argue for example, when you put something in water, you can see that's broken, and they say, okay, it's not broken, it's just in your mind, and it's, I think it's, I always thought that it was a good explanation of why the reality is not what you see. Yeah. And well, you say, okay, the intentionality is just what you, well, can, how can you explain this? Yes. Well, it's very basic, but well, I would like to know.
The next great question is perception. And what happens in perception? Now, I want to say, in perception, I don't see a representation of the object. I see the object. I see it directly. I don't infer its presence. I see it immediately. And I want to say it's wrong to think of perception as a representation. It's a direct presentation of the object. But I'm going to explain that in the next part. I mean, I'm not going to answer your question fully now, because the point about perception, see, there's a curse in our, well, there are three curses in our philosophical traditions. One is the mind-body curse, the idea that there's some interesting difference, that the mind is not a part of the ordinary physical world. The second great curse is you never perceive objects directly, you only perceive mental representations. And the third great curse is about causation. Causation is not a real relation in the real world. In the real world, they're just regularities. Now, these are all horrendous mistakes. I'm going to expose the one about perception in a few minutes, so I won't give an adequate answer to the question just yet. Okay, how are we doing?
So this is just a simple question. I was thinking, if the condition of satisfaction for an intentional state are determined relative to a network of beliefs,
so it
would seem like we might have a similar belief, like I have seen Girona, but a different network of belief, and this would sort of make the belief different. So could you say something about this?
I'm not sure I understand it.
Oh, sorry.
I have a belief that I'm in Girona. I have that belief only within a network of yeah. other beliefs.
I've also the same belief, but I've seen something different in Girona, so I think of Girona. I have a network of beliefs.
I see. If you think of Girona as a model city, only where everything's only an inch tall or something like that, then you have a mistaken conception.
No, I was thinking about a case in which we have seen pretty much the same about Girona, but yeah. I've seen something slightly different, let's say a square more than you.
Okay.
So the network is different, the belief yeah. is sort of the same, but they have different conditions for satisfaction.
Okay, no, so, this is characteristic of human intentionality, is you get an enormous amount of slack, and it seldom has the precision traditional philosophers want it. And this comes out in language. If you say, well, Girona is a city, well, what does it mean to be a city? A city as opposed to a town, and people differ. I mean, you don't get a perfect match, and this is what makes communication often difficult, is that people have different conceptions of what the facts are, and you get a certain amount of slack and indeterminacy in the representations that you make of reality, even in ordinary language, even in scientific language. You get some indeterminacy in the application of the terms. However, you get enough so that it, you get enough determinacy so that it works in practice. If you go into a store and you order a hamburger, well, you can pretty much count that they'll bring you a hamburger. And that's part of the background. But suppose they bring you a hamburger that's encased in Lucite plastic. Okay, it comes in a block of plastic, so you have to have a jackhammer to get it open. And they say, well, you didn't say no plastic. You know, I mean, they still, the background is that you presuppose that the hamburger will not be in plastic. But it would be slightly ridiculous if you felt you had to say, no plastic, no Lucite. Or suppose they bring you a hamburger, okay, but it's a 3,000-year-old Egyptian petrified hamburger, okay, taken from King Tut's tomb. And you say, but this is not what I ordered. And they say, it's a new hamburger. Well, okay, so in all of these cases, you take the network and the background for granted. You take it for granted when you order a hamburger that it won't be 3,000 years old, it won't be encased in plastic, it won't be petrified, and all these other things. All of these are part of the cultural and biological presupposed background. So within that, there is a certain amount of slack. Some people, Americans, are shocked in some places where when they order a hamburger, it doesn't taste like the hamburger that they're used to at home. By the way, in Catalonia, the hamburgers are superb because of the beef tradition. But this is a phenomenon. It's not a requirement for human communication, even for human civilization.
John, this is just another case of an old question, but I'm still worried about this. You know, the components of the network and the components of the background really have quite opposite properties, so to speak. Some of them represent, I mean, the components of the network represent the components of the background, whatever they are. We even do not quite know what the components of the background are, but what we know about them is that they are not representative. Yeah. Now, of course, given this kind of sharp opposition of what they are, we somehow, especially if we are realists, we somehow should believe that there is a sharp boundary between them, only perhaps that we do not quite know where it lies or whatever. So that would be one option. And of course, the other option would be that somehow, but that would need further explanation, that somehow, even if we are realists, there need not be a really sharp boundary, because there is some kind of not yet quite explained mysterious way in which the background kind of can shift or transform into the network and the way back.
Okay. Well, these are wonderful mysteries, and I will give the following inadequate answer to them. When we talk about the network, we're talking about things that we believe and also desire and intend. We're talking about the kind of things we just don't happen to be thinking about. It's part of the network for me that I keep my wallet in my back pocket. But that's just a kind of network belief, and I'm advised against it in parts of Europe where pickpocketing is common. So I carry these other things around. All of this is a network. But now I also have a certain set of background practices, ways of behaving. I tend to open my wallet with two hands and not one hand. I teach my money in a certain sort of way and not another sort of way. Now, all of those are just ways of behaving, and it's odd to think of those as additional beliefs. I find it uncomfortable to think of them as beliefs. However, often you can give a representation of the functioning of the background in terms of beliefs. So I told you, well, the skier behaves as if he believed that the angle of the turn equals the reverse camber of the ski, but of course he doesn't actually have that belief. That's just a way of behaving. You can represent the background as a set of principles that certain sorts of distance apart is appropriate when you're talking to somebody, when you're having a conversation. But it's a mistake to think, the way to understand that is to think we have unconscious beliefs. We have a belief that there's a right way to stand when having a conversation. No, I think that's just a style that we have. Cultures differ enormously in their background practices. A friend of mine was married to an Asian woman, and they went to Japan together. He's a famous linguist. The Japanese treated him very well. They were very polite to him, but they were shocked by his wife, because she didn't know how to hold a teacup. She didn't know how to pour the tea. There were all kinds of things that any Japanese woman would know as part of her background that this California Asian girl didn't know. And they would forgive him. He's some hopeless gaijin, you know. Who cares? I mean, he's outside of the boundaries of civilization. But from her, they expected the civilized behavior of a Japanese woman, and they were shocked when she didn't know how to drink her tea or even how to pour the tea. And I think all of this is background. It's just the sorts of things you take for granted in different cultures. And again, this is, you see, it is a commonality of background that makes translation from one language to another possible. But it's all sorts of differences in the background that make it hard to understand different cultures. I first read Proust when I was a teenager. And I have to tell you, the people in Proust did not behave like the people I knew in Chugwater, Wyoming, or even Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So when they go to a dinner party at these dreadful, it's in one of the early volumes, Charles Swan and Odette go to a dinner party at these, what's the name of these awful people? Vaurin, or something like that. Odette admires these people enormously. Charles thinks they're dreadful vulgarians, and he can't stand them. Okay, so the response is a matter of different backgrounds. They seem to me to behave very strangely, but still, there are a commonality of the background as well, because I knew that when they ate by putting food in their mouth and not in their ear. And that's part of a background decision. So that you can take for granted. It's this commonality of the background that makes it possible to study, to understand foreign cultures at all. What I'm trying to say is that the differences in the background made it puzzling to me how people behave in these novels, but a certain commonality of the background made it possible to understand it at all, because I could assume certain general things about the way that their civilization worked. However, I haven't really answered your question, but the point I'm trying to make is we bring to bear on any cognitive situation an apparatus and it's an apparatus that makes it possible to cope with the situation at all. Part of the apparatus is a set of what you might call explicit beliefs, what I actually believe in, as well as what I hope and fear and desire. I, for example, explicitly believe that at some time today we're going to have lunch. I don't know when, but I believe we're going to have it. Okay, now that's part of my network. Part of the background is that I assume I'm going to eat lunch by putting the food in my mouth and not stuffing it in my ear or absorbing it through my skin by osmosis. Okay, that's too fundamental to be just another belief. What do you believe about Girona? Oh, in Girona, they eat through the mouth. No, that's too fundamental to be a belief. That's part of what I take for granted. I have not found a way to give a principal distinction between network and background. And when we talk about the unconscious, I will explain why I think that has to be so. Our unconscious mental states are understood as mental to the extent that they're potentially conscious. So you do have unconscious beliefs and hopes and fears and desires, but you understand them as mental by precisely thinking of them as the sort of thing that might be conscious. Now this is important because in cognitive science, in the computational phase of cognitive science, the idea was that cognition is explained by a set of computational processes which are not the kind of things you could bring to consciousness at all. See, Freud's notion of the unconscious is a much more common sense notion because the unconscious is potentially conscious. But when Chomsky says the child learns a language by applying conscious innate rules, those are not the sort of thing you could become conscious of, because, for example, those would be represented as a series of zeros and one in a computational program. Or they would be represented by the linguistic. The linguist will say, the child is following the rule move alpha. But of course, the child doesn't know the Greek alphabet, even unconsciously. The child just behaves in such a way that we can represent it. And I think Freud's use is legitimate. That is, there is a form of unconsciousness which is genuinely psychologically real, but you don't happen to be thinking about it at the moment. But there's an illegitimate use of the notion of the unconscious where it's not the kind of thing you could become conscious of at all, and that seems to me not mental. Mental reality requires accessibility and principle to consciousness. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
This may be kind of hokey, but where do you situate faith? Would it be a sort of hybridization of belief and desire?
Yeah. Well, okay. Faith is a very strong form of belief. I typically held absence of evidence. And I don't have to tell people living on the on the Iberian Peninsula that this has been a very important issue in the history of Spain. And if you think of the history of the Inquisition and so on, they were always suspicious that people were inadequate in their faith or that they didn't really have the faith that they protest to have. I don't suffer from faith myself, but I think that in that respect I stand apart from the standard European history, because faith has been very strong in the history of the Christian religion. I don't know how strong it is in other religions. It's just a factual ignorance on my part. Yeah.
My question is a little bit related to what Nicole was now asking. It has not to do with faith, but with other characteristics a person might have, such as, for example, optimism.
Yeah.
Being optimistic.
Yeah.
What kind of what is that
okay.
in your picture? Is that
good.
Is that part of the network, the background, mental
it's
state?
It's tempting to think that all of these personality types, optimist, pessimist, and so on, that those consist of further beliefs. And sometimes they might. Sometimes it might be just a matter of beliefs, but typically it's a matter of background dispositions that predispose you to certain beliefs. So the optimist does not have a belief that he goes around saying, things are going to be great, things are going to be great, but rather he has a way of responding situations. In English, there's the standard joke, do you see the glass as half full or half empty? Well, the optimist sees it as half full and the pessimist sees it as half empty. That's a background disposition. So typically, optimism, pessimism, a general gregariousness, solitariness, those are background tendencies, background dispositions. Well, there can be both. You see, the background, there is a biological background. The biological background is such that I am predisposed to walk on my hind legs. Wolf children brought up by wolves, supposedly, I mean, we ought to do a systematic study of this, but they, on the popular accounts, the wolf children run around on all four, because that's the way they grow up imitating the wolves. All of that's biological. We're talking about biology. But cultural shapes these things enormously, and in ways that we're not fully aware of. So I gave you the example of how far apart we stand, but what is appropriate posture? What's an appropriate way to sit in a chair? What's an appropriate way to walk across the room? Those are all background phenomena, and they are culturally shaped. I think a culture plays. The culture can't move against the biology. There couldn't be a conflict between culture and biology, because biology would. But the culture can shape the biological basis. Then you have these constant tensions in the culture, particularly about sexual relations between the biological impulses and the way they're constrained by different cultures. So the form of the background is the cultural background, but the cultural background is shaped by the biological background. The biological background is common to all biological human beings. The cultural background shapes that enormously. And again, you see this from one culture to another. Europeans who visit the United States are always amazed at how friendly Americans are. They often mistake this friendship for long-term emotional commitment. It isn't. I mean, it's just they're being nice to you on this particular occasion. But it doesn't mean that 3 years from now that they're going to extend the same generosity. By 3 years from now, they will have forgotten you completely. So you get these variations that are very hard to cope with. And I told you the example of my friend who went to Japan, where they treated him very well because they didn't expect anything from him. But here is an Asian woman who does not know how to drink tea. That's unforgivable. They just couldn't cope with that. Yeah. Okay, coffee break after this question? Okay.
How would you relate the background theory, this theory, with the socialization, for example?
Yeah.
Because I think it's very related.
Socialization consists in assimilation to a cultural background. So the child, as the child becomes socialized, becomes assimilated to a background of the culture that the child grows up in. And it's essential. You see, here's a fascinating problem. What happens to children who are kidnapped into a different culture? In the 19th century United States, there were frequently cases of white children who were kidnapped by Indian tribes, by Native American tribes. Now, often these children would be rescued. They would be taken back into the white society. What is fascinating is that several of the children who were kidnapped by the Comanches in Oklahoma never reassimilated after they came back to white culture. In the case of Susie Ann Parker, she was captured back. She never relearned English. She had lost English, and she spoke only Comanche. She never could relearn English. She never could become an American again. She couldn't sleep in a bed. She always slept on the floor, and she couldn't sit at a table. She couldn't eat with a knife and fork. She had become a Comanche. And apparently there are crucial years where if you lose your native background in those years and acquire this new background, you never recover the native background. Absolutely fascinating studies. of white children captured by the Comanches, if they were captured outside the crucial age range, then they could become completely reassimilated into white civilization. But those who were captured, kidnapped in the special age range where they adopted a Comanche identity that stuck forever. They never reacquired the English language identity. My colleague Jennifer Hooten has studied these. She even learned Comanche to study them. And she is going to write a book about this, about identity and how it relates to culture and biology. These are fascinating issues. Okay.